And then 2 a.m, I sort of woke up, and then I realised I was actually in trouble, and it was in the dark. I got hit, obviously, at that moment, and then I got tied up. I wasn't sure what was happening, and I had to negotiate my way from thinking, shivers, this is almost over, to a point of, like, I actually want to live again. You're listening to the England Rugby Podcast, O2 Inside Line. I'm John Mitchell. I'm John Mitchell, the head coach of the Red Roses. The role of a head coach is firstly and foremostly to be a leader and to make sure that you enable your team to stay focused on the now, but I think it's my responsibility to be ahead of them and to make sure that nothing gets in the way of blinding us or preventing us from moving forward together as a team. What are the important qualities of being a head coach? I think firstly, a good listener. Being able to articulate clearly, I think, to declutter a lot of information, because like any industry these days, there's a lot of evidence, a lot of statistical information, a lot of visual information, especially in sport. And I think you've got to focus on success, not just on what's not right, because that can be perceived as judgment. Communicating well, but what's the big part of that is making sure that you keep it simple. So I was the oldest boy of the family. I got a brother of about 3 years younger, and my mum and dad were indoor basketball players. So I also had the experience of my mum being a marching coach. So in the old days, the marching girls used to be a team sport. So mum was a New Zealand champion in marching and also coached a team to a New Zealand championship. I was born in a little town called Hawera in South Taranaki, probably 5,000 people, I think. We were boys, so we had a go-kart, so that seemed to create a bit of fun. I couldn't work out when I was younger across the field when the football teams were playing that they had boots. And when I got taken to rugby, I had to play rugby in bare feet on the frosty mornings. I was sort of thinking whether I was going to go and play football because they had the boots. Little did I know that rugby was going to play a big part of my life, because I don't think I was contributing too much, because all I loved was, I had number 6 on my back of my jersey, and all I wanted to do was slide down the bank and get dirty. I wasn't really too interested in the game. Then I played a little bit at primary school as I got a little bit taller and developed, and I made the provincial team as a 12-year-old, but I didn't really start. I was sort of come off the bench. And then when I went to secondary school, I went to Francis Douglas Memorial College in New Plymouth, which is just a bit north of Hara. I played rugby and basketball in my first year, but when I got to my exam years, I had to make a choice between the two sports. So I chose basketball. And it wasn't until my last year where I'd already qualified for university, so I was doing scholarship and bursary to try and make physical education school. All my mates that were in seventh form, they said, why don't you come and play rugby? And I said, well, no, I can only play one sport, and I wouldn't mind trying to get the school to the basketball nationals. And then in the end, the school gave me dispensation, and I had a fantastic year. I played both sports, got a chance to play in the school nationals, and then represented the school at first 15 level. Got a real taste for it, loved it immensely. But as you can imagine, my exam results that year weren't too crash hot either. That was like the calling for rugby. So then I was challenged between rugby and basketball. My basketball coach in Hamilton, which is in the North Island south of Auckland, he noticed a few scratches on me and bits and pieces, and he said, you're not playing two sports, are you? And I couldn't be dishonest to him. I had to let him know that, yeah, mate, I've been playing rugby. And he said, well, you're going to need to make a choice. So I hopped on my flatmate's scooter in Hamilton and went to a rugby club called Fraser Tech and played for that club for 14 years. Where I had to adjust and get my head was around the physical contact, the high to low aspects of rugby. And initially that was slow learning for me, because I wasn't physically a big guy, but I did love the physical nature of the game, even though I wasn't really prepared for it at that point in time. And because I think I was pretty driven and competitive, I think that got me through. Then I got a few injuries that sort of like scared me a little bit and probably gave me advice around and awareness around that I need to get stronger. And then just the camaraderie afterwards, you know, the fact that it was very much a game for equals, where it didn't matter where you come from, it was just very neutral and people just treated you for who you are, but also made it very, very clear that you're accountable and committed to helping that club win. in the earlier days when I went from, I guess, being noticed as a club player to play for my province, Waikato, you had to mix two club trainings a week with two provincial trainings, which was sort of met in the centre of the province. So you're sort of like 30, 40 minutes away. So you ended up having pretty close to four trainings a week, and I was still having to work as a quantity server. So never really had any illusions or vision, I guess, that rugby would ever go professional. If you wanted to play at that level and aspire to become an All Black, you had to put more in. So I had to find gym in the mornings, or I had to find gym at lunchtime, or I had to find, you know, running sessions in the evening to grow that way. And then we were very fortunate enough to eventually get strength and conditioning advice, but there was never any mental performance advice or anything like that. It was really just put your head down and try and find ways to advance. And then the provincial rugby started to increase a lot. My boss at Foster Construction, where I worked as a quantity surveyor, he said, geez, you're having to take a lot of time off. And so I started feeling guilty about that, but I was really fortunate. I had a work colleague who played for the same rugby club, so he used to cover for me for when I used to go to the doctors for antibiotics or get stitches out. We played the Wales midweek on a Tuesday, I think, and we played the British Lions on a Tuesday as well. So you can imagine after those victories, they were quite big nights, and you still had to arrive at work in the morning at 7:30, you know, to ready for work. I must admit I wasn't in too good a state on those two occasions, but that's the way it was. Obviously, I managed to make the All Blacks through a team being successful and for a period of time, and kept knocking on the door and got a tour here to Britain. And then just around that time, rugby went professional. I came to the north of England, to the Manchester, where Paul Turner was the official head coach at Sale at that particular time. And we were entering professional rugby for the first time, and I was coming over as an assistant coach player. And then when I got there, Paul left the club, and I was then presented with the opportunity to lead the club as a player coach. So in the first year of professionalism in Sale, which was a fantastic year, we ended up playing the cup final here. It was only six of us that were professionals, which is probably 20% of the squad, and the other 80% we used to have to wait until they finished work and they would come in and we'd do our training. So so I prepared, you know, for games and coached the side for a whole year as a player coach. And it was really just, I had to learn how to swim, really, to be fair.
In goes the big shove, controlled by John Mitchell at the back. North Auckland, they are in big trouble. John Mitchell picks it up and dives over for the try.
I'm Zoe Alcroft, and I play for Gloucester, Hartbury and England. John Mitchell, he's very straight to the point. I think you know where you stand with him, which is something that I really do admire of a coach. And he's just brought in so many new ideas that kind of like I haven't really heard of, like a shape I've never seen that before. So it's really nice to be able to freshen it up.
I'm Maud Muir. I play for Gloucester, Hartbury and England Rugby. I'd say Mitch is a balanced person. I think he has a really good balance of both fun and enjoyment, but also when we get down to the gritty nitty bits, he's really on it. And I think that balanced part is so important in a coach. Yeah, I'm excited to see where he goes.
It's there, and this time it's a try. It's the number eight, John Mitchell, who controlled the ball at his feet, and Waikato post their first try.
So if you can imagine, when I first came to England in 95, as a player, I was built on the approach and style of New Zealand rugby. But when you get immersed in English rugby culture, you're involved in 40 games in a year, that was probably one of the best apprenticeships you could ever have. You know, like as a player coach, didn't know what I was really doing at the start, except I was a captain for a long period of time. So I thought I could manage different people quite well. Little did I know that I had a lot more to learn in that area as a coach. So I was built on rugby, English rugby culture. So immediately it gave me a different perspective on how the game could be played in different ways, rather than just being settled on one particular way. So I think that's held me in pretty good stead. The English culture is something I do love. It's something that I love, the way they represent sport. Every weekend there's something different to look at and learn from in England. So for me, I've always found it rewarding and refreshing to move to places and be challenged either with a side that's strong or a side that's developing. I guess the older I've got, I've probably less excited about travelling somewhere and flying somewhere. And I do prefer, like I do have now, is really the ability to go home each night. To give you an idea of the movement and the challenge from it, so did England for about 4 years, 5 years, then went back around the millennium, coached the All Blacks, then went to Western Australia in 2003, became an inaugural coach of the Western Force. That was a good challenge. Was I ready for that challenge at that stage of my career and experience? Probably not. Likewise with the All Blacks, you know, I coached the All Blacks at 37 years of age as well, very young, and then obviously then went to South Africa and got the Lions going again. You know, they'd been on a trot of 17 games in a row that they hadn't won, so now I'm back in England. I've been 21 years away from New Zealand now in my life, so as much as I'm respectful of that heritage and a lot of the good things that it offers, you know, England's very much my home now. It comes through its costs as well. You know, I got divorced, you know, 13 years ago, and a lot of that was my own doing because of the fact that I got consumed by the game. I was over-focused on it, put too much time on it, and ultimately, end of the day, it was costly, you know, because that didn't work out, and that was my own doing. What's the drive? What's the thing that keeps me going? Why do I still want to coach and get better? If I go back to Australia 2003, where the All Blacks, we lost the final to Australia. That wasn't obviously the outcome that we're after. When I returned to New Zealand, rightly or wrongly, yeah, I was put under the microscope. I remember the day flying back. Little did I know that there were going to be a huge amount of media waiting at the airport. I was very invasive and rude. Some of the public were really good to me there, allowing me to just be like a normal person catching a flight. Then I had media stuck outside my home for over a month. I had people following me to the gym. I became very hard on myself around that outcome. At that point, I lost my way as a coach because I got overconsumed around wanting to prove to myself and people that I could make teams win. And that was costly for me for a four-year period because it wasn't until I went on a social trip in France, 2007, which rekindled my spirit for rugby, and we saw the demise of the All Blacks. And it was a really big wake-up call to think, well, look, I've got my focus wrong. You know, why am I focused on outcome? And I need to make sure that I enjoy this process and I need to evolve as a coach. Did I know myself well enough as a coach back then? I don't think I did. I think I knew my coaching process, but I think when you want to be a really, really good leader, you've got to trust yourself first. So that's easy for me now, whereas I don't think that was as clear. And because I got overconsumed about wanting to prove outcome, I lost the art of staying in the process or evolving the process. And then there's a guy called Simon Hurry who came into my life in South Africa who was sort of like a person who understood how to communicate effectively with different personalities. I had no risk involved in giving him an opportunity. So in that university side, I said, look, would you, if you want to pilot and use it and help me grow. So he did, he shared that with me, and ultimately he profiled myself. He was able to interpret that really well for me. And that just allowed me to understand a little bit more about how to communicate to different personalities, which was really invaluable. And, you know, like I've probably had that in my toolkit now for pretty close to, you know, 12 years. If I hadn't come across him, it might have taken a little bit longer to even develop. But yeah, no, I hold dearly there and are grateful for the opportunity to have met him.
My name is Jules and I am John Mitchell's wife. We actually met many, many years ago, long before he actually came to South Africa, but he was living in New Zealand. Obviously, I was living in South Africa. So it really was a slow sort of introduction to Mitch, really, over many, many years. He, in his quiet way, stands out in the crowd. You know, so we just make the most of our time together when Mitch is at home. Obviously, that's a lot more now that he's with the Red Roses. He's so kind and caring and such a peaceful person. And I think that calmness at home also, I can see with his role as a head coach, he wants to listen to everybody and advise them and guide them. And with that, gain their trust, which will hopefully transfer onto the field as well. Oh, I'm very proud of Mitch. Honestly, he loves a challenge And I think for him, he really feels that he can make a difference with the Red Roses. I mean, they are already a great team. I can see the excitement in his face every day when he gets ready to go off to work. His empathy, his love for his family and his friends. You know, when Mitch does something, he really does it 100%. Otherwise, he doesn't do it at all. Yeah, that for me is just epitomizes who Mitch is. Just 100% lovely, kind-hearted, amazing man. And I'm very lucky that he's mine.
There came a period of time when I was in South Africa. I just immersed myself at the Lions. I was on a contract period because Dick Muir, who was the director of rugby of the Lions at the time, he asked me to come over to help him in that Currie Cup. So I sort of like fully immersed myself into it. I think we were 3 months into the job. I was living with the strength and conditioning coach because my family were in Perth. And I think it was towards the end of the Currie Cup. It was a stormy night. And typical Kiwis, we probably didn't respect security enough. We just left our windows open and stuff like that. But clearly somebody had been following our pattern for a period of time and obviously saw the branding on the vehicles and stuff and found a weakness in the complex. And then 2 a.m, I sort of woke up and thought it was my strength and conditioning coach, Wayne Taylor, thought he was playing a game on me. And then I realised I was actually in trouble and it was in the dark. I got hit, obviously, at that moment. And then I got tied up with curtain cord wire and mobile phone wire. I was tied up into a roast chicken, and then my head was buried in the pillow. I was stripped off as well, which was really scary because I wasn't sure what was happening, and I had to negotiate my way from thinking, shivers, this is almost over, to a point of like, I actually want to live again. So I need to put away my ego here and try and negotiate my way out of it. So what do you want? Take me to the ATM. What do you want? Hit my mobile phone, like, kind of thingy. And it seemed like eternity, but I think it was only an hour. Wayne had fled to try and get help, and I think he was, you know, like, wasn't sure what he was going to come back to. Then all of a sudden they came back and I heard these African voices, and I wasn't sure whether it was more people involved, but it actually was the police and stuff. Yes, I was really fortunate. They got me in my leg and my arm, and they didn't get my artery, thank God. I had a little bit of insomnia for a while, and light actually became my friend during that period of trying to deal with it. I think I got over it a lot quicker than even Wayne did, because the fact I knew exactly where I'd been touched, how I'd been hit. There was no guessing around what if. I knew exactly everything that happened to me in that situation. It's amazing the state you go from being like, I'm in proper trouble here, to a point where I actually want to survive. It's not something you want to go through too often, I don't think. The reflections and what did it do? It made me just show more courage, take the handbrake off, and in some of the areas of life where I thought were restricting me is in terms of what I wanted to do and who I wanted to be. And I think it was a real key moment, and that just really take the handbrake off. If you can decide to do something, be totally all in. Stop being cautious and afraid about some decisions and make them and get on with it. For me, I think that was the best thing out of that situation. Like, dare I say it, things happen for a reason. Not that I wanted that to happen, but it probably was the proper wake-up call that I needed.
I'm Wayne Taylor. Everybody calls me Tails. Known Mitch for quite a long time now. Briefly met when he was coaching the All Blacks, but then we spent a considerable amount of time together in South Africa. We actually lived together in Johannesburg when Mitch was coaching the Lions. It was a sequence of events that were quite, I suppose, coincidental. It was the last weekend of Currie Cup, and we played on the Friday, not the Saturday. The end result was they probably didn't expect us to be home on a Saturday. We should have been out at rugby, but we were hungover and sleeping. So, you know, we laugh a little bit at it now, but at the time it was like really traumatic for us. You know, we were two Kiwis in an environment that you probably wouldn't encounter in most countries. You know, I managed to get out the window and then get to the main guard to get security to come in for us to come back in. But could have ended really a lot worse. It affected us both. There's no doubt about that at all. We spoke a lot to each other, and I think we really struggled. You know, we didn't go out socializing much, and we were probably, our senses were heightened. We were very aware of any situation that we were in. We leant on each other a lot. You know, we were really compassionate towards each other and understood we had good days and bad days. And I've always had good experience with Mitch. You know, he's always positive energy and bouncing off the walls with everything he's doing. And everything he does, he either does properly or doesn't do it at all. The things we've achieved together, I'm really proud of. And Mitch is technically a really good coach. He's smart, does his homework. You know, he goes and he puts good systems in place. I'm not at all surprised with the success that he's had and the teams he's been with. And I think having him now with the England Women's program is going to be a huge asset.
I watch a lot of sport, so I'm a lover of sport. So you start sitting in your lounge and you see the exponential growth in women's sport. The Lioness is doing really well in the Europeans. And then I started watching Six Nations. I was with Wasps, which went bankrupt. But I was just sitting in that space, so where to next? Where can I find an opportunity? I think that's going to be really challenging. I took it upon myself to have a cup of coffee with a couple of people from England Rugby around what sort of coach they were after in the Red Roses, whether my skill set was something that they were looking for. The deeper I got into that, it gave me a lot of really good information around, you know, the why I was doing it. I owed it to myself that I wanted to head coach again. And then obviously I watched the girls play out here in the Grand Slam decider last year. The vibe that was presented on that day was really encouraging. Once I did commit, I was always promised myself that I wouldn't premeditate the differences. Got to the tournament in New Zealand with the World 15 and started building relationships with the girls and the staff and everything from that point onwards. So the rest is really just around trying to become a better team, improve our performances by focusing on some new detail. What does it need? What's its potential and growth? Firstly, we're extremely well resourced already. We hold the 30th biggest contracts in world rugby. They're like gold that allow those girls to be, you know, fully professional. I liken our scenario at the moment very similar to when rugby went professional in the men's game in 95, where you had a partial group of professional players and the rest had to come in from work. So I guess it's how do we find more professional days for the girls that are still having to get into training from work? We're very fortunate every weekend in PWR that we have 90 English girls playing rugby and we get to select, you know, the best 35 that we have. For a professional team, I think eventually we'll need a consistent training base to evolve our girls, because I think we do move around a lot, how we create more consistency around that. And then we're going to have to focus on the mental side of the game as well, because as the demands become greater, as the noise and the judgment on socials and stuff that they're going to have to deal with over time. So we've got to be really mindful around the wellbeing piece as well as the mental performance piece. The only thing that I can remember, and clearly that's difference, is when we played in Wellington against Australia, it might have been nerves or whatever, or it might have been just normal conditions of a coach. You know, so we go to the changing room and I was about to go for a nervous toilet, and I'm about to enter into the changing room, and the doctor, Dr. Lewis, he was brilliant. He goes, "Mitch, not here, you're down the corridor." And that's the only difference that I've come across. What are some of the other noticeable things? Just love their the mental state they adopt on training days, on buses. So, yeah, they tend to adopt a different state, I think, pre-game. It's just a little bit more, I wouldn't say it's relaxed, but it's just, I think, the fact that they like to connect and sing and be in large groups is just the way that they go about things differently to the men. The why for the girls is still the legacy of the Red Roses. The why is, you know, there were 65,000 people out here last year, but we'd love to fill the top green seats as well so that we have a presence here on a more consistent basis. That's still a big driver, and we ultimately owe that to the predecessors. We also owe that to the younger generation as well, and we need to make sure that we capture and connect with our community. Coming up next on England Rugby Podcast, O2 Inside Line.
at that time, I thought my world had ended. I didn't get into Southwest Regional. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know how I can even continue rugby.